This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 8th of October, these are our main stories. There's mounting concern in the US over President Trump's decision to withdraw US troops from northern Syria, abandoning his Kurdish allies. Striking doctors in Zimbabwe are defying government orders to go back to work, and the journalist that's putting periods into the spotlight. Also in this podcast, the small domestic bird that's causing a huge headache for Spanish authorities. As we recorded this podcast, President Trump was facing intense criticism, including from his own political allies, after he announced the US was pulling its troops out of northern Syria, leaving Kurdish fighters and their families incredibly vulnerable. Leading Republican Lindsey Graham said the move would put every radical Islamist on steroids. The Kurds are US allies and have been fighting the Islamic State group alongside American troops, but Turkey says they're terrorists. The main Kurdish-led group says they've been stabbed in the back. At a press conference, Mr. Trump repeated warnings to Turkey that they can't capitalize on the absence of US troops and said it should be up to Middle Eastern countries to fight their own battles.
Iran, as an example, hates ISIS, and ISIS hates Iran. Iraq, you know all about that. Turkey, Syria, let them take care of it. We want to bring our troops back home. It's been many, many years. It's been decades in many cases. We want to bring our troops back home. And I got elected on that. If you go back and look at our speeches, I would say we want to bring our troops back home from these endless wars.
We'll hear from Washington soon, but first, our international correspondent, Orla Gurin, has this report from the Turkish-Syrian border.
U.S. military vehicles withdrawing at dawn from positions on the Syrian border, leaving the way clear for an advance by Turkey. The message to Kurdish forces, America's allies in the fight against Islamic State, you're on your own. A spokesman for the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces branded it a stab in the back. He said if Turkey attacked, they would send their soldiers to the front line, which would allow IS to regroup.
We think it's a kind of give them the opportunity to reorganize themselves. And this is a very bad situation, and everybody should be against this one. Still, Daesh is not finished yet.
There are fears that the US withdrawal and a Turkish advance could allow a resurgence by the extremists. There are thousands of IS prisoners in the region, currently in Kurdish detention centres. But Turkey has tired of waiting for the US to help create what it calls a safe zone, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan appears poised to go it alone soon. We have made a decision, he said today. There's a phrase we always use. We can come any night without warning. He has said the goal of the operation is to water the east of the Euphrates River with fountains of peace. But Turkey wants to push the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG, from its southern border. It regards the militia as an extension of the banned Kurdistan Workers' Party, which has been fighting for autonomy in Turkey for over 30 years. The question is what Turkey's fight against the Kurds may mean for the global battle against IS.
That was Orla Gurin, and I spoke to our North American correspondent, Peter Bowes, about what might happen next.
It is not in Donald Trump's nature to back down, and he is certainly standing by what he said overnight in that very explosive series of tweets, but he has been elaborating on his thoughts in that most recent news conference at the White House, perhaps with an eye on trying to bring around some of his harshest critics. This is very much in keeping with what we've heard before from the president about not fighting endless wars. We've heard that in relation to various other hotspots in the region. We've also, I think, had from him a little bit more detail on that discussion, that telephone call he had with Turkey's President Erdogan. He said he warned the president that he went through with his threat to invade that region of Turkey, and that if US troops were hurt in the process, there would be big trouble, said Mr. Trump. And he said he told Turkey that if it did anything outside of what was considered humane, well, Turkey would suffer the wrath, or could suffer the wrath, of an extremely decimated economy. Again, that adds to the threat that he made earlier in a tweet.
And he's really setting himself against the establishment, isn't he? With even people like Mitch McConnell saying they don't agree with it.
Oh, yes, against the establishment, many within his own administration, his political foes, his political allies as well. Like, as you say, Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, he issued a statement. He said a precipitous withdrawal of US forces from Syria would only benefit Russia, Iran and the Assad regime. And he said it would increase the risk that ISIS and other terrorist groups regroup. And I think most significantly, you mentioned Lindsey Graham earlier, another strong ally of the president, describing this decision as impulsive.
I mean, you could also see this as a distraction from the impeachment, if you're being really cynical, because I've got the TV channels in front of me and no one's talking about that today. They're all talking about this move in Syria.
Yes, we know that President Trump has been talking about pulling troops out of Syria for some time. This hasn't come out of the blue in that respect. But he hasn't really lived up to his word. It's gone. It hasn't gone, as you have noticed. It hasn't gone unnoticed here that this development in the last 24 hours does come as impeachment talk is really reaching fever pitch, especially on the all news 24 hours a day channels in the United States. And I think with the subpoenas that we're seeing flying around for documents, the Democrat-led investigation in the House all heading up to a crescendo in the next few months. Yes, that's been dominating the 24-hour news cycle until today. It has been a distraction.
Peter Bowes. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has urged the United States to waive the immunity given to the wife of an American diplomat. Harry Dunn, who was 19, died at the end of August when his motorcycle collided with a car close to an Air Force base. The driver of that car, Anne Sekulis, left the UK after the crash, despite telling officers she wasn't going to. Duncan Kennedy reports.
Harry Dunn was just 19 when he was knocked down in August and died of multiple injuries. It was from an American airbase 200 yards away that Anne Sekulis drove her car before hitting Harry. She subsequently left the country, despite being the main police suspect. Today, in a highly unusual move, the Prime Minister intervened in the case to call on the Americans to overturn her diplomatic immunity.
I do not think that it can be right to use the process of diplomatic immunity for this type of purpose. And I hope that Anne Sekulis will come back and will engage properly with the processes of law as they're carried out in this country.
That call for the Americans to act was shared today by Northamptonshire Police. Superintendent Sarah Johnson said she shared the family's frustrations over Anne Sekulis' decision to leave Britain.
It's difficult when the suspect has left the UK and obviously causes delays in the investigation, but we're working really hard to make sure that we gather all of the available evidence that remains for us.
The American State Department has offered its condolences to Harry Dunn's family, but say it's rare for diplomatic protection to be taken away from an individual. But the former Foreign Office Minister, Tobias Elwood, said 20 years ago the American authorities asked for a Georgian diplomat to be returned to the United States after he was involved in a fatal accident.
In 1997, there was an appalling pileup of cars in Washington, D.C., caused by one individual, a diplomat from Georgia. And the country itself waived diplomatic immunity so that individual could face trial. So this was the United States requesting support to deal with a road traffic accident in its own country. I think that does set a powerful precedent.
The Foreign Secretary is to raise the case of Harry Dunn with the American Secretary of State later tonight.
That was Duncan Kennedy. Now, women's menstrual cycles are the subject of a wide array of misunderstandings and myths worldwide, with many cultures hiding the biological process, often due to feelings of shame. Here in the UK, the BBC presenter Emma Barnett is bringing periods out in the open, announcing that she was menstruating on live TV news and writing a book about why we need to smash the stigma around having a monthly period. Emma spoke spoke to Dan Damon about some of the myths surrounding menstruation.
Yes, I mean, this idea that we... I'll talk about the broad themes that we curdle dairy products. Mayonnaise will go off. I believe that's still going strong in Madagascar as a myth. You know, that people's teeth will turn to spikes. The idea that crops will go bad if women who are menstruating go near them. The fact that, I don't know, that we're some kind of curse, essentially, on all sorts of life and food seems to be the theme of keeping women still, very and on a very serious note, away from the rest of their community when they're menstruating.
And some of this is religion-based, but not all of it, is it? I mean, religion is used to subject women to all kinds of all kinds of humiliation and repression, but it's not just that.
No, I mean, looking even closer to home in the British Medical Journal, I was surprised to see it was as late as the 1850s that two male doctors, apparently men of science, also thought women would turn meat bad if practicing being doctors, if practicing medicine, the idea that a menstruating woman still could make things go off. So, Pliny the Elder was also talking about this based on philosophy, apparently, that, again, you know, being this whole idea of a menstrual woman having some kind of dirty impact on society around her is socially and religiously and culturally embedded in societies.
And that's your message, isn't it? That it's up to women, that men should learn a thing or two, but they don't go through this, so they won't make the changes to society that would, for example, stop women having to feel embarrassed if they have to go to the loo during working hours and all of that. It's up to women. But why have women not taken on that role?
I think we have and we haven't. I think it is something we can conceal quite well. We learn to do it from a very young age. And it's probably not the most popular thing to say it's down to women. You know, I make the joke, we've got enough to do, I'll add another job to your list. But it's not in men's interests, quite frankly.
Let's talk about openness. You, in the book, you talk about Kiran Gandhi. I think she's a musician, but she ran the marathon and she was just about to go for a good time. Period started. She didn't want to use a tampon, so she bled as she ran. Mm. There was a lot of comment and quite a lot of pictures didn't appear in the papers, actually. Mm. What's your view on that? Is that kind of openness needed?
I mean, it was striking. We have photos of all sorts of violence and bloodshed all over the news all of the time. And in the end, all that resulted was a small patch of red on her running leggings. I mean, it wasn't a massacre. I would say you don't need to free bleed, as it's called, to get this openness. But there was something quite amazing about just seeing that, because she's right. Anyone who's worn a tampon doesn't then feel like running around in one.
If it's routine and monthly, it's not dirty, is it?
No, it's pretty normal. It should be, yes. I think the reaction to some things that happened to me on the way to getting people's stories about this, whether it was broadcasting about it, whether it was debating somebody, you know, one of the headlines read, woman calls is a sexist row by saying if men had periods, the world would be a different place. Well, it would. Tampons would be free, like soap and loo roll. We wouldn't be having to pay for the privilege of bleeding. I've been called a moron by people online for this. There's a lot of support, but I'm also really interested in the hostility towards this. Why so hostile? What's there to be afraid of?
The BBC presenter Emma Barnett, whose book is called Period. Next, an independent online air quality monitor, Air Visual, says it's under coordinated attack in Vietnam and has suspended its apps and Facebook page. The announcement comes after Hanoi recently topped their list of the most polluted cities in the world, Vahana Darwood reports.
Air Visual is a Swiss-based firm that publishes air quality data around the world, often in places where no reliable official readings are available. It also sells air monitoring equipment, air purifiers and face masks. Last week, Vietnam's government warned vulnerable people to limit outdoor activities in Hanoi following several days of bad air. Many residents in the city were concerned.
At the moment, air pollution is the main concern of many people.
I'm still getting outdoors, but I feel that the air is a bit suffocating. At around 7, 8 in the morning is when it starts to get worse and the level of unpleasantness also rises.
All I see is dust. These days, the environment is no longer clean. There is dust in the air almost 24 hours a day.
The government conceded that the levels of hazardous small particles in the air in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City have been rising persistently since early last month, exceeding Vietnamese standards. But over the weekend, Air Visual's Facebook page and Google Play presence began to receive a deluge of messages from users accusing the site of publishing unreliable data in a bid to sell its products. The company said it had received abusive and threatening messages and has now suspended the downloading of their apps and their Facebook page in Vietnam. Air Visual said its data has helped raise awareness of air quality issues, but this also made it a target in Vietnam. In a country that rates poorly on press and internet freedom, red flag trolls who support the government by attacking pages deemed to be unpatriotic are common. Air Visual has been among the most downloaded apps in Vietnam.
Fahana Dawood. Now to Madrid, where parakeets are causing a headache in more ways than one. The authorities in the Spanish capital say they intend to drastically reduce the population of an introduced species of the bird after their numbers ballooned by a third in just 3 years. They say monk parakeets pose a threat to native species and also to public health. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard.
They're noisy and gregarious, and they're annoying some of the neighbours. Monk parakeets are doing well in Spain, too well for some. They didn't ask to come. They're a subtropical species from South America, but they were brought over as pets and released or escaped. Some 12,000 now live in the parks of Madrid. The authorities want to reduce this massively. Precisely how is yet to be worked out. It's likely to include capturing and killing the parakeets and sterilising their eggs by injecting air. Animal rights activists have reacted angrily to proposals in other parts of Spain to shoot the birds.
That was Danny Eberhard. Still to come in this podcast. The Korean musical genre that's churning out rock stars. And no, it's not K-pop. Doctors in Zimbabwe have defied a government order to resume work. They've been on strike for 5 weeks. Here's Merlin Thomas.
Doctors have vowed to continue their protests, saying that the galloping inflation has effectively reduced their salary to less than $100 a month. The economic crisis in Zimbabwe means that many can't even afford to get to work, as it costs around $80 to fill up a car with petrol. Negotiations with the government have been deadlocked since the doctors rejected a 60% pay increase, demanding instead that their salaries be pegged to the US dollar. They've now appealed to the World Health Organization and local businesses to raise money to supplement their wages.
Merlin Thomas. When an indigenous representative at the Vatican Amazon summit was mocked for wearing feathers on his head, it provoked strong criticism from Pope Francis.
Después el desprecio. Ayer me dio mucha pena.
I was very saddened to hear, at this very place, a sarcastic comment about that pious man with the feathers on his head who brought the offerings. Tell me, what difference is there in having feathers on your head and the three-cornered hats worn by some officials in our Vatican departments?
The Pope has also been attacking what he calls colonial ideologies. Our Americas editor, Candice Piat, told me more.
They were applauded there, and but I'm sure they were a little toe-curling for those present. Now, he was using it really as a teaching point in his address, saying that modern society shouldn't try to impose its ideology and rules on indigenous people and should respect their culture and allow them to plan their own futures. He said the church had to control its impulse to domesticate indigenous people as if they were wild things. He has in the past apologised in the name of the church for the first colonisers in Latin America, and he said many European missionaries who arrived had a derogatory attitude to indigenous people and their culture. So this is not a new idea for the Pope to be presenting.
And what else did he have to say?
He spoke very interestingly about his native Argentina. He said the European settlers there had had disdain for centuries for indigenous people, that the two cultures had been described as the difference between civilization and barbarism. And this led to the 1880 military campaigns against the Indians, which basically obliterated most of the communities in Argentina. And that disdain, he says, still exists today. We still speak today, he said, of a second-rate Indian civilization coming out of barbarism. barbarism. Argentinians used the words, he said, like little blackhead to describe Indians.
And it's part of a much wider issue, isn't it?
Pope Francis is really reaching into the divisions that still exist today between indigenous cultures and the culture of the descendants of Europeans across Latin America, where discrimination, distaste still exists for indigenous communities. They remain the poorest and receive the least support and help from the state, and they're still left fighting a losing battle for their remaining territories and for the rights to live as they wish within their culture on the land.
Candice Piat. The Iraqi president, Barham Saleh, has gone on television to call for calm after a week of anti-government protests that have left more than 100 people dead and thousands injured. He condemned attacks by both sides, calling the perpetrators enemies of the people. Almost all the casualties have been demonstrators voicing hopelessness in the face of corruption and unemployment, and the president said those in the streets deserved political reforms. The prime minister has ordered the prosecution of soldiers or officers found to have used force. Baghdad is now said to be relatively calm, and the internet has been restored after being cut for days. My colleague Divya Arya spoke to Issam Ikamawi, senior correspondent at BBC Arabic, about the feeling on the ground.
People have all sorts of grievances, but deteriorating living conditions in Iraq, high unemployment, high prices, Corruption is rife. Some experts speak of $450 billion have vanished since 2003 from Iraq. We have to bear in mind that Iraq is a wealthy country. They've got oil, they've got water, natural resources. So in theory, Iraq should not be suffering as a consequence. But the reality is corruption is rife. Various administrations have failed the people. They've had lots of promises about we're going to do this and that and the others, reforming the economy, creating more jobs, fighting corruption, but nothing happens. So one of the slogans that people have been carrying on the streets of Baghdad and other cities is that enough is enough.
And all of this protest has been quelled in a very violent manner. And now we are hearing that, in fact, some Iranian militias may be behind that violence. What do we know?
There have been reports and rumors that, for instance, we were shown documents, Iranian documents, which allegedly were seized from some of the snipers. But there's no evidence that this is the case. I mean, the fact that you could find some Iranian papers, ID cards somewhere, doesn't mean that a person was involved in the confrontation. Because most of the big projects in Iraq are carried out by Iranian companies. Iranians go to Iraq because of the holy places, the Shiite holy places. So there is a strong Iranian presence in Iraq. There have been rumors that the Iranians are behind some of the militias, which have been, you know, quelling the protests. As I said, at this stage, there's no concrete evidence.
A lot of our listeners would not remember what the country has gone through. If you could remind us.
Well, I mean, since the fall of Saddam Hussein and the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, on the surface, on the outside, Iraq has been liberated from a dictator. And then you've had a series of elections. All this, like, what appears to be like democratization of the Iraqi state system. However, what happened in reality is that the sectarian aspect of Iraq has devastated the country, because you had militias, you had armies, semi-official armies, working for certain religious authorities, some of which are linked to the Iranians, some of which are independent from Iran. So Iraq as a country has broken up.
Issam Ikamawi, editor and senior correspondent at BBC Arabic. Police in the Indian city of Mumbai say a seemingly penniless beggar who was killed while crossing a railway track has actually left behind savings of more than $14,000. And Barisan Etirajan has the story.
Local residents said the 82-year-old Biradichan Pannaramji Azad for years used to beg in the suburban trains in Mumbai. After his death, inquiries led the police to his shanty in a nearby slum. To their surprise, they found coins to the value of $2,500 in containers. There were also records of his bank deposits. His family is believed to be from the state of Rajasthan, and Mr. Azad had named his son as a joint holder of all the bank accounts. Efforts are on to find the son and the rest of the family. All these years, his neighbours thought he was a beggar without a family.
And Barison Etarajan. Talk about climate change can at times feel a bit abstract, especially when discussed on a global scale. But the wildlife cameraman Toby Strong has witnessed the effects of climate change firsthand over his 20 years working in the field. He's recorded audio diaries for the BBC from the various locations he travels to around the world. A few months ago, we heard from him in Kenya, where he was filming rhinos. This time, he's in Mongolia with nomadic herders and horsemen.
It's very hard to convey the scale of this landscape. The skies here seem bigger than anywhere else I've ever been. There's a subtle aromatic scent. It's the wild grass and herbs. It's like a lemony thyme and sage. As you walk and the animals walk past you, it sort of kicks up this lovely, lovely smell. The other half dozen times I've come to Mongolia and filmed, it's been in winter when it's minus 30, minus 35. So this is really nice to come back in the summer and see endless meadows of wildflowers. Mongolians are arguably the king of horsemen. To try and film them is really difficult. I am not the king of horsemen. So using the drone a lot here. It's wonderful flying over this landscape, looking down, seeing these guys cantering around. The Mongolian way of life is as nomadic herders. As global warming is taking effect, the summers are getting hotter and hotter and hotter, but equally, the winters are getting colder and colder. And so in the summer, they're now getting droughts here, and that is killing off their livestock. And what livestock remains isn't producing that much milk. And Mongolians live off milk and dairy products. And in the winter, the temperatures are plunging so low that even these hardy animals are dying. That's leaving these herders without any livelihood at all. And so they're being forced into Ulaanbaatar, the capital, to these slums all around the edges. And it's a pretty desperate situation. It's late afternoon. The heat's gone out of the day. Chores are done and the children are tumbling around by the horses. Just been sat with Huiga, our driver, having a cup of coffee and some snuff. We've been talking about the weather. He's in his 70s. Now he says you just don't know what's going to happen. We can have flash floods, we can have droughts. Then he said he's worried about the weather. He says something feels wrong. We're packing up tonight and head off very early tomorrow, and we'll leave this beautiful family here in their gur in the centre of these huge plains through the long winter. And I wonder how much longer this family will be able to live the nomadic herder lifestyle that has been lived here for thousands of years.
That was wildlife cameraman Toby Strong. And now an item from Korea that isn't about politics. Listen to this. A Korean music festival is underway in London, and it's not just about K-pop. What you heard was traditional Korean opera known as pansori. People queue for days to get tickets to performances like that, involving just a singer and a drummer. Dan Damon spoke to Anna Yates Liu, an expert on pansori, about the rock and soul... sorry, culture in Korea.
The really star pansori singers have rock star status, and they've had rock star status for decades in some cases as well.
And why? Because to put it simply, it is just a singer and a drummer on stage.
It's just a very intense art form. One story can go on for up to 8 hours, but once you're then really falling into that world, the intensity that a singer has to maintain for that length of time, telling all the stories by themselves, the sounds of nature, a battle scene or whatever, all by yourself, it's an incredibly difficult skill, and those that appreciate it are stunned and blown away when they see it.
What are the stories? They're very ancient, aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, there used to be many more. There's only 5 stories preserved today, and they're kind of built around these sort of fundamental human relationships, often with a kind of Confucian bend in terms of, you know, relationships between king and subject, father and daughter, brothers, friends. And so it's really these fundamental aspects of human life that are told within these stories.
It's about the creation of Koreanness.
Well, yes. I mean, pansori is also very much these days considered one of the fundamental art forms that represents Korea and is very much presented as such when you see it abroad. And it really is. You can learn so much about the Korean culture by listening to these stories.
And let's take a quick listen to one of those stories as we end this edition of the Global News Podcast with me, Charlotte Gallagher.
장춘장 아니다. 주장 진장 아니다. 송장 구둘장 아니다. 아이고 이거 무엇이 이놈이.
If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
저 집으로 들어가면 여보게.